Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse. Today is January 1st, 2025. Happy New Year's, everyone. I'm going to be your host, Eric Osterman, and I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator focused on AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So, how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format's very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, this is a great place to ask those questions. For those on the recording, we host these calls live. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. I do have one ask. If any portion of today's session is valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. We'll be posting a recording of this session in a few hours. So here's what caught my attention this week. Now it is, the lull between Christmas and New Year's. So there has been a very slow news cycle of interesting things that caught my attention. Here was just two that jumped out. First one is, as you all know, Mitchell Hashimoto left HashiCorp last year at some point and has a new side project. He's kind of been having this passion project developing the most performant terminal emulator. So if you're familiar with like iTerm2 or Putty or things like that, that is what this is, except for this one leverages the GPU and OS specific bindings so that you get a better performance. It's interesting. I haven't tried it out yet. I personally haven't felt like the terminal slowed me down too much, but then I can't, I've no, nothing to compare it to. And I'm not tailing logs all day to notice performance issues. Curious if anyone has tried Ghost TTY out. Or Ghosty, I guess.
Not yet. No, I tried another one and then back to iTerm.
Back to iTerm. Yeah. I haven't even, I used to use iTerm back in the day, and these days I don't even bother on a new Mac. I just use the one that's built in.
Right.
Yeah. Anyways, nice to be able to just, have that kind of capital that you can just work on whatever that, tickles your fancy for as much as you like. So really cool to have those passion projects, and we'll check this out. My next announcement was just one that was dropped in the Terraform channel. Shunsuke is a prolific open source developer. He has like 100 tools that he's worked on or implemented on his Git repo. He just promoted a new one here. Oops. Why is it? So this one helps you refactor Terraform configurations. For example, if you have inconsistent naming conventions, some are using some resources have dashes, some have underscores. This will help you rewrite that in the Terraform state file for you. I mean, you could accomplish something similar using sed. It's just that it's a lot more error prone. This is actually understanding the document model for a Terraform state file and then making those substitutions in both the Terraform code itself as well as the state file. So the idea is, of course, that when you run this, that there should be zero drift if you if it was successful. So that's cool, and it supports JSONet expressions. All right, any other announcements? That's all I got. All right. Well, let's jump into a Q&A. Any of you have some questions I can help get answered or any points of discussion?
Hey, Eric. I don't have a whole lot really. I was just kind of, curious about Cloud Posse and I still don't know a whole lot. Like I was
Yeah.
saying, yeah, I kind of have to do some more looking into Cloud Posse, and how did you guys get started?
Yeah, great question. Happy to share. So, it was back in 2015. I was an independent consultant doing a lot of, DevOps type contracting for companies. And I just got tired of doing the same thing over and over and over again. So what I did was I started writing Terraform modules that were reusable, that implemented things. And, step away now, nearly 10 years later, we have hundreds of modules. It went from just being me to now I have a team implementing everything. And we also developed a lot of interesting insights into what was effective strategies for reusable infrastructure. So if you look at our modules, they're pretty opinionated in some ways. One of the things that we came up with was this idea of the null label. And it's a naming module that's pretty popular, and it helps you come up with consistent resource names. And then we came up with this idea of context so that all of our, so we could pass that around, and then all of our Terraform modules work really well together. So
Oh,
that's what we were
excuse me.
looking for. Go on.
Why is the label null for use?
It's a great question. Terraform as a language has evolved a lot. And back in the day, you couldn't do any of these naming things without using what was called a null resource. And this is going back to early versions of Terraform, like 0.7 and 0.8 and things like that. Well, eventually that was no longer required. And now this module doesn't use the null provider anymore. But because the null label module receives, tens of thousands of downloads a day, we just never renamed it because it would be disruptive to everyone. There's actually another really cool thing that we have, which is called the context provider.
How do you keep all this stuff updated? I know you say you have a team of people, but like that's the sort of scary thing for me with stuff like this is like it seems like someone makes a cool template and then they are on to the next, project or whatever. And
Well, so that's why there's I think a lot of misunderstanding of A, what it takes to do open source and be successful, and B, some fear associated with that. So this would not be possible without the support of our community. So if you look at all the pull requests that we have, there are thousands and thousands of pull requests, and they've all come from people as yourself or others using the modules. And what makes that possible is that if you look at our modules, they have tests. And all the tests are what we use to ensure that for the most part, we don't break support for that.
So you wrote your own test harness or what?
Yeah, somewhat. So there's a tool called TerraTest by Gruntwork, and we use that in all of our modules to implement tests. At a minimum, smoke tests, like does it plan, does it apply, does it cleanly destroy, and so forth. But some modules, like for EKS, which is pretty critical, we have some more elaborate tests going on to ensure it's stable. And the tests are what enable us to accept pull requests at a faster clip from community members. And it's also often a big differentiator between modules that are built in-house that often lack testing at all. So in-house modules, you can get away with not having tests. However, if you have as your team grows, you have a bigger problem because how can those team members contribute to your in-house library of reusable modules and so forth? So for the same reason software has tests, your infrastructure as code should have the tests.
Agreed.
And then what happened was we were implementing this over and over and over again, our modules, and we realized that the current tools on the market were not optimized, at least to how we saw, to create reusable infrastructure and we had to piece too many different tools together to try and get something to work well. So we started working on Atmos, which is a framework for how to do infrastructure at scale. It allows you to separate configuration from code and describe reusable catalogs of configuration that you can reuse over and over again. So that's Atmos. If you've heard of like Terragrunt, it's in that category, but I don't really think of Terragrunt so much as a framework as I do a tool to, overcome some limitations in Terraform. So yeah, check out Atmos if you're just getting up to speed on things and you're curious about how that could maybe make your life easier with Terraform.
Cool. Is that the Bubble Tea Golang library?
Yeah, we use a lot of the Charm Bracelet libraries, Bubble Tea, Glamour, Bob, actually, it was one called Boba or something.
I've just seen that stuff. I haven't. I'm waiting to use it. I need to build a cool CLI.
Are you a Go developer? Oh, cool. Well, we have a large backlog if you get into it.
I got my own backlog. I always end up contributing somehow. So yeah, thanks.
No, it's great. These things with open source, it is a labor of love. We've been at this for 10 years and it's taken a long time to get here, one grain of sand at a time, but it's really exciting to see what's happening. And now we get a lot of contributions and we're starting to see contributions coming in on Atmos, which is exciting, and a lot of things planned for it. So,
Cool. Okay. Great. Thanks for
yeah.
sharing all this.
Hey, Hamza, any questions?
Yep. I have one.
Oh, yeah,
So,
fire away.
lately I've been using Terraform for deploying my applications, my infrastructure, sorry. So, but when I try to destroy the infrastructure, Terraform couldn't delete. He say that there is a dependency somehow. So I tried to search on some blogs or some stuff. I found that there is AWS Nuke, package, but I wasn't that comfortable that much to use. So I was
They're
afraid
taking a
that
sledgehammer
or like, but are
to
there
your
any
infrastructure.
yeah are there any tool or any technique to resolve that kind of problem? I mean, to delete certain resources for specific VPC.
Right. Well, let's take a step back, right, and understand the problem a little bit more. This is a problem that we use, or we have sometimes. We also use AWS Nuke, actually, so I'll talk about that. But the solution is often based on what you're trying to solve and is sometimes not always a technical one. So let's talk about infrastructure and what gets you into this problem or this pickle to begin with. If you're writing Terraform, and for the most part, everything is a Terralith, things get easier. Building it is easy, destroying it is easy. Terraform calculates the DAG and the dependencies and the order of operations and can pretty much do everything for you. But we know from experience that a Terralith also has a lot of problems, that the surface area of any change is everything. And that's dangerous. It's hard to enforce controls on who can change what, because that same plan can change anything. And then you have this problem where it takes more and more memory to compute. It takes longer and longer to run. One of our customers to run Terraform Plan on one of their projects took 25 gigs of RAM. The next thing that happens after that is you hit rate limits on the cloud provider. So we break our infrastructure into pieces. But in the problem solution cycle, every solution has a new set of problems. And it sounds like that might be where you're at, because what you've maybe done is you provision a VPC in one component, in one root module, and then maybe you provision a cluster in another one. And now you can no longer destroy the VPC until you also first destroy the cluster. And then how do you manage those relationships? And it gets messy.
Eric, real
So
quick, that you said the limits, would that be with like Amazon APIs or limits somewhere else?
oh, those are limits with API providers themselves, yeah. When you have too many resources under management in the same Terraform root module, at some point there will be a ceiling that you hit where you have too many API requests per second to AWS, or per hour if you slow down your rate limit, and you're gonna max that out. It's
Okay.
set, it ha, it's here's the thing. It's not a problem until it's a problem, and when it's a
Yeah.
problem, it's a big problem. Because you basically have undeployable infrastructure. Then you have our problem.
Yeah.
So, it was actually a perfect question because we have all of those Terraform modules that I was showing you a second ago, and those modules have tests, and those tests do things like bring up a VPC, bring up a cluster, and then maybe deploy something to the cluster. And well, sometimes the pull request is flat out broken, or it fails, or it leaves all this stuff in an incomplete state, but we don't care about it. So in our situation, what we do is we always set a default tag in the provider configuration to a specific value so that we can then run AWS Nuke on everything with that tag value. That works for testing. It's really convenient. So then we can always have clean everything up that was orphaned as a result of that Terraform test. But if you're doing this in like a production setting, it's a little different. You can still do the same tactics, but it's a little bit more messy. And you're going to orphan the Terraform state files as well because those don't have tags on them.
Can you set up AWS billing groups kind of automatically as you deploy through these?
That's a good question. I mean, this is what's really nice with Azure subscriptions. I don't know on AWS if you can do that or how to work with billing groups in that way. I know you can set up cost allocation tags, and we can set up all those tags that way.
Oh.
I'm not as familiar with what IAC exists around billing groups.
Yeah.
We don't support any IAC with billing groups.
Okay. And IAC is what do you mean by that?
Oh, infrastructure as code.
Okay, got it. So, but so for not the billing groups, but you guys do support some ability to like apply labels or something for
We do too. So one of the things we have is this thing called the reference architecture. This is what we've implemented with Atmos. It leverages all of our Terraform modules and components. And what we support out of the box with this is a tagging architecture. So all your resources are tagged in a consistent way that is extensible as well. And we also support billing or AWS budgets. So you can set a budget for every account, and then you can set up notifications associated with those budgets that notify via Slack if those budgets are exceeded, or based on a extrapolation that Amazon does, they can tell you if you're on the trajectory to break your budget for the month. There is more that can be done, but that's kind of what we do right now.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Eric, about the problem that I was talking about, I think that the main cause of the problem is when I deployed ALB. I think when I installed ALB, I installed Argo CD, and I think Argo
Yeah.
CD has also installed some
Yeah, yeah,
security group stuff, or I don't
yeah.
know,
Yeah.
and
Well, it gets messy because you're spanning tool chains, right?
yeah.
So what happens is you're deploying EKS, probably with Terraform in the cluster, still no problems. Then you're deploying Argo CD, cool. But then Argo CD deploys an ingress, and the ingress is probably not using an ingress group associated with an ALB that was provisioned by Terraform. So now you have this other resource that's deployed in the VPC, and now you can't just do clean shutdowns and destroys. But that's just one example. Now with Argo CD, you're deploying your complete application architecture on there. And if you're using controllers that create, like if you're using, was it AKS or was it Amazon controllers for Kubernetes, ACK, then that's going to be provisioning things possibly in the VPC and IAM roles, and you'll have other resources. And now you're spanning multiple paradigms, and destruction is non-trivial.
Got it, yeah. Okay.
And we
Thanks.
don't have a solution for that too. And the reality is this, is that there's what you do for test automation, that is a tractable problem. But then there's what you do in real world infrastructure, and real world infrastructure you almost never tear down to zero. So what you should be testing is that you can recreate everything. And how you destroy it probably will be messy business. And if you can, just use, like you said, Nuke to do that. So from a DR perspective, I would be testing that you can bring everything up and then just nuke it when it's done.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, appreciate you.
Also, that is, it's interesting. So we have at Cloud Posse, this organization called Terraform Components. Components are the deployable level of modules that we manage in our reference architecture. One of the things that we are working on right now with all of our components is implementing automated tests as well. So here's an example of automated testing of our VPC component. And what's cool about what we're doing here is under the stacks folder, we're distributing a couple test cases here of deploying a VPC. For example, one here is with IPAM, one here is with flow logs. And in this implementation, we wrote something called a test helper. And test helpers are designed to work together with TerraTest, and they're all in Go. And with this, what it does is it uses Atmos to bring up a complete architecture and then tear it down again. And it also comes with Nuke out of the box. So if you have any, like for example, if you were doing this for DR purposes, when we're a little bit further along in the automated testing here, that could be something interesting for you.
Okay. I'll take a look at it, yeah. Good. By the way, do you have any experience with the KS and other CNI than VPC CNI like Calico or
Yes and
Cilium?
no. So I'm a little bit less hands-on keyboard these days because the team itself does that. But our reference architecture includes EKS. We use by default the default AWS VPC CNI, so that it all the pods get IPs that are addressable and routable between all the different AWS services. I can try and answer some questions, depending on the level of depth you need.
I've been curious about the implementation because I didn't find that kind of documentation that explained it all. And also EKS been saying that you should, or it's recommended that you use VPC CNI. So like you said, so the pods get an addressable IP across your cluster. But I don't know, sometimes I feel that one of your project may maybe need Calico for some kind of business, but I don't know.
So, let's see here. Hold on, let me, there was a, well, so first let me share the documentation that we have, in case it's interesting. So under our reference architecture at docs.cloudposse.com, we have this section called Set Up Your Platform. Underneath that, we show our docs for EKS and so forth. And what's special about all of our documentation is it embeds a handoff as part of it that explains kind of why how we arrived at our solution and the considerations therein. And we also talk about some of the design decisions that you should be aware of. One of the biggest problems with EKS on AWS and networking is that EKS that that's the VPC CNI is incredibly greedy for IP addresses. And that's because provisioning a ENI is a relatively slow process in the container land. So it pre-configures a lot of ENIs so that when a pod comes online, it can just associate the ENI with a pod. But that means that even if you don't have a lot of workloads running, EKS is still consuming a lot of IP addresses. And then because the CNI support is using actual ENIs, you're limited by the number of pods you can have on a node because you're limited by the number of ENIs. So then you end up needing to have very large instances. But unless your pods are very meaty, requiring a lot of CPU or a lot of memory, your utilization on the nodes could be relatively low. And this is where it gets interesting if you switch to if you support other CNIs. I believe EKS supports multiple concurrent CNIs, and you don't have to have the same CNI for everything. However, obviously, you do create partitions where if you have some on one CNI, those workloads won't talk to the other workloads on the other CNI. In terms of Calico, never comes up in any of our engagements. For the most part, if more advanced networking is needed, especially for end-to-end TLS, Istio comes up frequently. And then there's the other CNI for EKS that is what Google uses on GKE. What was that?
Multis or something like that is, I think it.
I'm drawing a blank at the moment. What you said didn't immediately trigger a recollection. One second.
CNI, okay, I know Multis.
Oh, si is it? I think it might be Cilium.
Oh, okay, yeah, Cilium, yeah.
Yeah. So
I
it's
thought you mentioned
Cilium.
it,
So
yeah.
Cilium can also be implemented as a CNI for EKS. And we tried doing this in a recent engagement. Trying to automate the deployment of Cilium on EKS using Terraform isn't possible. And it's actually really cumbersome to deploy altogether. Unless you're using EKS Cuttle, EKS CTL, which supports it out of the box. There is a order of operations that has to happen, and it's not really easy to do with Terraform. So we just did WikiOps, documented process for setting it up, which we almost never do. But therefore I don't recommend Cilium at this stage. Because if you can't easily set it up with automation, to me it says that the project is immature. Let's see what else. Yeah, feel free to ask any other questions on those. I think I forgot to share the link here in the chat.
I have a more a less tech question, but kind of still tech. So this year, I'm trying to do more about having visibility beyond just where I work. And I was trying to decide if I want to spend more time writing blog posts. I haven't really done that seriously, but I, even though I'm still pretty young in my career, I think I do have some things I could share. Of course, with the caveat of I can't actively write about anything at my current job, but my past experiences, I have many things that I could write.
Your current job wouldn't let you do any blogging?
I could, but then I would have to do it through the official blog and go through that process,
Oh.
which is it's not that onerous of a process, but I just want to practice, like exercise those writing muscles first, and
Yeah,
then when I
exactly.
feel better, I can go through the official blog. But then the other aspects I was considering, maybe it's just better to just spend my time just contributing to open source projects. Like you said, you have a ton of Golang issues or something like that. But I know that I have limited time, and I'm trying to figure out what is bang for my buck in terms of doing that. And then the other side about it is I don't exactly know that I am good at self-promotion or enjoy it. I know people like you will run your own business, spend a lot of time on LinkedIn,
Yeah, you
writing
have
about the
to.
stuff that you do. And part of me is terrified about having to start doing that. And so if I write all these blog posts but no one reads them, what's the whole
Yeah.
point? So a lot of things swirling in my head. I just wanted to get
So,
out.
let's draw the analogy to working out or physical fitness, right? We all know that we should be working out and practicing physical fitness and eating right. However, we take on those challenges head on too big so that the habits don't stick. So, you got to start small, build up, and find the reason, the purpose you are doing it. Because if there's no purpose, working out is just not going to stick. The same is true for writing. You're going to have to find the purpose that is meaningful for you, and it can't just be to get ahead. You got to find something that you find personally satisfying about that process because the reward is so far disconnected from the effort, right? That reward can come months or years later from doing it. And I think, you brought up a good point, that you have to write more to get to practice and do that. And one of the best rewards you get from writing is crystallization of what those concepts mean or how those things work. It's almost like, until you start writing, it's almost like describing a dream. It seemed really lucid, when you experienced it, but then when you try and relate it to a friend, it makes no sense. Writing is similar to that, in that until you start trying to explain how these concepts work and fit together, you realize, I didn't really quite understand it as well as I thought I did. So I think it'll serve that benefit, but that alone, at least for me, wouldn't be enough. And that's why I think the most important thing is to find a side project, something that is a passion project, something you're interested in that you're doing for yourself, regardless, that has tangential benefits career-wise in what you're doing. That way you have the payoff personally for doing it, and then the professional recognition that comes from writing some of the blog posts and so forth. For me, what I think is the most valuable, here's the difference for me. If I see, if I, if, Let's say we're looking at two candidates, and so far they look pretty close. One candidate is contributing significantly to open source. The other candidate is writing a lot of blog posts. Let's assume that when I look at the pull request, I like it. I think it's showing professionalism and thoroughness. And let's say when I look at the blog posts, I like it and thoroughness. So what which how do the candidates stand out? Well, I'm probably going to think that the candidate that's writing more blog posts is probably a good team member and is probably good at explaining things to other team members. If we need technical documentation associated with their work, I'm probably going to think that they would be good at doing that. They might understand the concepts pretty well, but I still, there's a big difference between writing blog posts and the examples that you put in blog posts relative to what you actually have to do to get the job done. You want simpler examples, and simpler examples are hard to make too. So this is not a criticism, but they're also simpler examples. And
Right.
it's not showing me that, so I think somebody who is You can also come up with simple examples, and the more experience you have, the harder it is to come up with simple examples, if that makes sense. So now the guy doing the open source pull request, I can see what it's going to be like working with this person. I can see how they respond to pull request comments. I can see the rate at which they're opening pull requests. I can see the quality of the work. I think from if I'm looking for somebody who's actually going to produce for us, then I think I'm going to rank all things equal the one with a better open source profile over the one with the blog post. Now, but that's totally subjective. Who's going to have the same criteria as I do? I don't know.
I'm a big fan of GitHub contribution graphs. Like, I get it. Not everybody gets to have their own GitHub account or that they get to use work, but even if you don't, there's still like open source work that you could be doing. I just think that there's kind of like no excuse anymore for people to not really have a solid graph.
I'm sympathetic to the people who are in some enterprise environment and they're really strict about it and some of these things. And well, maybe that limits some of their ability to contribute. But I will also say the best developers that I know, they have their own passion projects. They're doing things on the side that necessitate them contributing to other projects with pull requests and so forth. And if somebody doesn't have a personal profile and is doing nothing on the side, then this is just a means to an end and not a passion for them. And that's not necessarily wrong, but there's a difference when somebody's really truly passionate about the work they do. They're always thinking about it. And they're getting the tangential experience. Even if they're not working at your company doing work for you, they have these side projects where they're learning new technologies, new skills, problem-solving techniques, etc., that are invaluable, even, in their day job. So I agree with you, Michael.
Yeah, I seem to learn the most after I get a new job, right? I'm like done with something. I worked at HP for a long time, so we, did things the HP way, and then I left HP after like 13 years and back into like the things that I really enjoyed doing again and coding and all that. And like the amount of stuff that I was just able to learn and I'm still learning, like, it's like I know people don't like a new job every year on the resume or whatever, but for me it seems to like my next employer is always going to be the one that
It's a, there's a double-edged sword, right? Because I'm an employer, so I
yep
get it as well. And you're right. You do learn the most stress fractures happen in the beginning in a new job where both you need to quickly demonstrate your value, but also there's so much new material and new things to learn and things like that. I get it. And that's why I think consulting is a really great way to get a lot of experience. Because you can be at the same company, but you can be working with so many different clients, and each different client, new stress fractures, new strengths develop.
Sometimes you're right about that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's no truism,
Like if you
but
specialize like at HP, I was like kind of like with one product, right? And you just kind of do that for a long time. Well, then you're not always learning these things. So.
Isaac, any more thoughts on this?
No, that's very helpful. I definitely do see how, as an employer, or even when I, for a short period of time, when I did sort of have to lead a team, if I was in a hiring position, I too would go for the person that has demonstrated evidence of being able to hit the ground running and contribute. So, yeah, it makes me think more that my time might be more wisely spent since I have a finite amount of time working on the open source. And then occasionally, if I do have something particularly interesting or insightful, I might write a blog post here and there. But
Well, and I think you strike me more naturally as a developer, right? I mean,
yeah. True.
Given 10 hours, would you rather spend 10 hours writing or 10 hours coding? And
Oh, easy.
easy, right? Okay, so then I think open source contribution will strengthen your or pad your resume as best as possible. But there's other people who would answer that differently. They were English majors in college, and they love to write, and that's how they express themselves. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's just different, right? So this is where, in general, in life, I think the more we accept our strong suits and invest in those, the farther along we will come, and then find someone else to do the things that we don't like to do.
That makes sense. That's helpful.
So, yeah, and I think there's also just contributing to a lot of different projects just shows your ability, like you said, to hit the ground running because they have different coding styles, they have their unfamiliar code bases. You have to, figure out where to make those changes. And that's impressive. So, like this guy, Shinsuke, that was showing earlier, this guy has like of his he has 500 of his own repos, but then he's contributed to Atmos, he's contributed to other projects that I follow. I keep coming across his GitHub handle, and this is where, like, this guy is really good. Anyone would be lucky to have him on their team.
I just want to add to that too. I've learned a lot from different, contributing to different projects through code review, right? So
Yeah.
PR and then getting beat up in code review and there's just tons that you're gonna learn there. So like find some gurus to learn for. That's free training. Like that's just so valuable.
Yeah. So then, what projects do you contribute to?
Sure.
Because just contributing to open source by itself, again, it's just like writing that blog post. It's not fun if you're not even using the software, right? It's just unpaid work.
For
So.
me, it's like I find something that I find something that I want to use that doesn't have a feature that I need, right? And then I
Right,
just
exactly.
that's kind of easier to say, or it might be easier said than done, but that's how it works for me.
That's exactly it. So, and then, but why doesn't it have this feature that you really want? And that's because you have a project, a problem you're trying to solve, right? So you have to find the problem first that you want to solve, find the tools that will solve it, and then contribute to the tools that help you solve your problem that solves your own, scratches your own itch. And that's the like end-to-end story that happens.
Yeah, I think it for most people it needs to be like a product, right? Like or a website or some sort of project. Like I want to build something, and then it's, okay, well, what do I need? What's my stack gonna look like? Okay, I like this and that, and kind of mixing and matching software, and then you'll find holes that won't be able to plug.
Exactly. So that's why my job here is to say that you should start using Atmos, and then when you run into problems with Atmos, you should contribute pull requests to that. So speaking selfishly. Oh, hey, Michael Jenkins, I didn't see you join.
Hey, Happy New Year, everybody.
Hey, Happy New Year's. Good to see you here.
Yeah, I've never actually played with Atmos, so I'm gonna give it a shot and see what's going on there. It sounds magical from everything I've heard, so.
There's a cliff, or there's a yeah, you gotta there's a learning curve associated with it still, but once people get it, it's hard to do things any other way. It really grows on you as
I
a person.
have lots of my own personal Terraform projects, and I mean, I think this is true for most of us who work on this, but I have tons of AWS accounts that I deploy different things to different things, especially sometimes it comes really handy for real work because you don't want to destroy your work environment, and so that's something. I guess my question is, how easy is it to start using Atmos if you already have existing Terraform infrastructure and you're not starting from scratch? How easy is it to
It's
adopt it?
so th th it's a thing kind of like It's relatively easy. However, you might not get any of the benefits because Atmos is not just a tool to run Terraform. Atmos is a way to think about architecture. And if you think about architecture in a way that's similar to how Cloud Posse thinks about architecture, then it's just going to be like, wow, why didn't I try this sooner? Like, why, I had to do all these crazy things with shell scripts and wrappers and things like that before, and now presents a really elegant way of doing it. However, if you aren't thinking about infrastructure that way, then it might not, then the benefits aren't there for you. Right? Benefits are relative to the problems that you have, and you might not have the problems that we had that we tried to solve. I don't know if you were on the call earlier. I think Hamza was bringing up a question about how to destroy Terraform resources when.
I was here for that.
Exactly. And well, okay, so in this particular solution, I don't necessarily know that Atmos would help you destroy the infrastructure associated with that. Other than you could create a workflow in Atmos that tears that down in a way that you validated that works. But what it does do is make it a lot easier to decompose your infrastructure in a conventional manner, passing state between those pieces of infrastructure, but still treating them totally separate. I guess the way of thinking about it is, are you familiar with Helm charts?
Yeah, I am.
Are you familiar, you don't not necessarily having used, but are you familiar with Helm file?
Yeah.
Okay. And are you familiar with umbrella charts in Helm? Like when you have one Helm chart that instantiates a bunch of other Helm charts?
Not very familiar with those, no.
Okay. So a lot of people, when they start using Helm and Helm charts, is that they write, let's say you write a Helm chart for Argo CD, you write a Helm chart for, I don't know, some database dependency, and you write a Helm chart for some controller that you need to deploy. Then you can create a Helm chart that installs those three Helm charts, and that's called an umbrella chart.
Got
And
it.
when you do that, it's very convenient to deploy. But those things are forever kind of combined together, and it's really hard to dismantle that umbrella chart.
Right.
And what I've described is how a lot of companies write their Terraform, is that they have a root module, and then they have a lot of child modules, and then they have a child module for Argo, they have a child module for the VPC, they have a child module for EKS, they have a child module for this other thing, and they put those all into one module. And that's very convenient to deploy and destroy, but you get into this problem where at some point there's a tipping point, it doesn't work anymore, it doesn't scale very well, and if you ever want to refactor it, it's a nightmare. So Helm file is really nice because with Helm file you describe all the things you want on your cluster. You say, I want this chart at this version, I want this chart at this version, I want this chart at this version, I want these values passed to it, and it gives you a declarative way of doing that you can recreate and have any number of environments and things like that. So we really like that because now we didn't have this problem where if we realize later on that we didn't want to deploy the database together with the application, that we aren't in a pickle. It's very easy to decompose that with Helm file. Well, Atmos is like Helm file in that sense. But it, instead of it just being for Terraform, it supports Terraform. It also supports Helm file, actually. But we also want it to support CloudFormation. We want it to support Ansible. We want it to support all these other tools down the road and provide a consistent declarative way to describe what constitutes a logical stack. And we believe we have a schema that does that in a very future-proof manner. And then Atmos is kind of the tool that ties it all together.
I see. Can I pose a hypothetical, and you can let me know where I
Yeah.
would come in with this
Yeah,
idea?
yeah, yeah.
So I don't. Are you familiar with the GitOps bridge idea that's been floating around a little bit? So if you're going to do, for instance, EKS, right, you're going to run on Kubernetes on AWS. The idea with the whole GitOps bridge thing is that you set up, just the bare infrastructure with Terraform, and then everything else you do with Argo CD, right? So you pass, for instance, role names by saving it into an Argo CD, like something on the cluster. This, and then everything else you deal with Argo CD. So in this, theoretical framework, what does Atmos do for me?
No, it's a great question. So Atmos is everything up to the point of Kubernetes, and up to the point of getting Argo CD up and running. But once you have Argo CD up and running, Atmos is no longer involved, at least at the juncture that we're at right now.
Okay, so it can take care of all my, it's mainly focused on the setup, the infrastructure side.
It's exactly. And it stems from where we have our start as a company, is that we come into companies and we start everything always at ground zero. We never go into an existing environment and start trying to work with it. It's just too much of a liability for them and for us. So because we always start at ground zero, we needed something that we could capture the repeatable processes to bring up a complete environment from scratch in a repeatable way.